Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to this evening's program hosted by VivaFest and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Marcella Davis Naviles, and I'm executive producer of VivaFest. It's my honor and great pleasure to introduce Linda Ronstadt, an iconic singer and songwriter, arts and social justice advocate, and now a best-selling author of Simple Dreams, a musical memoir. Ms. Ronstadt's artistry and leadership speaks for itself. She has earned 11 Grammy Awards, 2 Academy of Country Music Awards, an Emmy Award, an ALMA Award, and numerous United States and internationally certified gold, platinum, and multi-platinum albums. She has also earned nominations for a Tony Award and a Golden Globe Award. She's collaborated with artists from a diverse spectrum of genres, including Bette Midler, Billy Eckstein, Frank Zappa, Rosemary Clooney, Flaco Jimenez, Philip Glass, Carla Bley, The Chieftains, Emmylou Harris, Graham Parsons, Dolly Parton, Neil Young, Johnny Cash, and of course Nelson Riddle. She has lent her voice to over 120 albums. Christopher Luden of Jazz Times noted in 2004, Ms. Ronstadt is blessed with arguably the most sterling set of pipes of her generation. She is the rarest of rarities, a chameleon who can blend into any background yet remain boldly distinctive. It's an exceptional gift, one shared by few others. In total, she has released over 30 studio albums and 15 compilation or greatest hits albums. Ms. Ronstadt has charted 38 Billboard Hot 100 singles, with 21 reaching the top 40, 10 in the top 10, 3 at number 2, and You're No Good at number 1. In addition, she has charted 36 albums, 10 top 10 albums, and 3 number 1 albums on the Billboard Pop Album Chart. Here's my favorite factoid. Her album, Canciones de mi Padre, is the biggest-selling non-English language album in United States history. And from 2008 to 2010, the San Jose community was honored to welcome her to the artistic directorship of its beloved Mariachi Festival, from which she retired in 2010. And she continues to be a passionate supporter of arts education and social justice issues. Later this spring, Ms. Ronstadt will receive the prestigious honor of being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And moderating this evening's conversation is a wonderful woman and a good friend of mine, Ms. Barbara Marshman. She's editorial page editor of the San Jose Mercury News. Barbara has been editorial page editor of the Merc since March of 2007, and she's been with the newspaper for 25 years. She grew up on a farm in Boyertown, Pennsylvania, and graduated from Westchester State University. She was a reporter and editor for several small daily newspapers in the Philadelphia area until she won a John S. Knight Fellowship and came to California in 1987 to spend a year at Stanford. And she never went back, and we're glad she stayed. So please welcome and join me in welcoming Ms. Linda Ronstadt and Ms. Barbara Marshman.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
I'm going to do it too. Thank you. Linda was just asking me backstage if there's anybody out there. I think there are a few people.
I didn't know if there
was an audience. Yeah. So just for a baseline here, how many of you are fans of Linda's Going Back to the Stone Ponies?
Oh, my God.
Okay. We are all traveling to the same drum.
Yes. Tonight.
Well, it's a delight for me to be here, a true honor, because I've been a fan of Linda's. We are the same generation, almost the same age, and I've been a fan of yours forever.
So. Thank you.
Why don't we start out talking about your childhood, because
okay.
It fascinates me. You've had some difficult times. Your mother was ill for a long time, but it just sounds idyllic growing up in
well,
a musical family.
Well, it depends on what you think of as idyllic. I mean, the desert is an equal opportunity. You know, you can die of exposure any time of the year. And I always say, Tucson, where spring is not a promise, it's a threat. So, you know, and everything stings you, and there's thorns, and everything bites you, and it's not a comfortable, but if you're desert born, there's something that happens to your soul. You get very into that kind of terrible discomfort. So, but I love it, and I still go back like a lemming, you know.
Well, you know, since you mentioned the desert, I was thinking about your musical family, but since you mentioned the desert, one of my favorite characters in the book, and one of the best drawn, is Murphy the Pony.
Oh, Murphy, he was so cute.
Now, Murphy the Pony, the astonishing thing is you would go out with a girlfriend and ride in the desert all day, and sometimes Murphy would throw you and so on.
Mostly he would throw me off.
You were 5 years old.
I was five. It would sound like child abuse, but, you know, in those days, that was the way it was. You got up in the morning, you got your clothes on, you went out, you found the gang, if there was a gang of one, you know, because we lived pretty far from other people.
Yeah.
And I was really just so grateful to have a friend at the age of 5. She was 7, and she could do everything that I could do, but way better. So I thought that I couldn't do anything at all well. But I just kind of followed her around. She had a really nice pony. Her pony didn't buck, but mine did. So I spent a lot of time on the ground. Our parents really, they cared about us. They fed us and everything like that, but they just didn't hover over us. I'm very an opposite kind of a parent.
You know, I was going to ask.
I think I'm going to say, oh, be careful, you get hurt. Yeah. I'm one of those, oh, be careful, you'll drown, you know.
So you didn't let your kids ride their ponies across the desert by themselves
at 5? We had a pony for about 5 minutes, and the pony, I moved back to Tucson, and nobody had a pony anymore because everything had been developed, you know.
Yeah.
Everything, all the places where ponies were going to live had grown houses. But we had a weird little pony that I brought to my house and kept in the backyard. But there were military planes flying over, and it scared him. And he wasn't very friendly. He would rear up and try to hit us with his front hoofs. So I sent him back to Ponyville.
I wondered if those, the freedom of being able to do something like that as a child, if that was part of nurturing your creativity almost as much as your
well, maybe
musical
maybe
family.
It was part of my just kind of, you know, couldn't stay any place. It for five, you know, I couldn't stay with any kind of music, or, you know, I would just move to the next place. I was very restless. When I listened back, I put together a compilation of duets recently that they're going to release in some form or other. You'll be able to buy it down at Target, I think, or something like that. At any rate, because that's the only place they sell records anymore. Isn't that funny? There are no record stores. I mean, who would have thought it? But anyway, I put that together, and it was from, you know, this time to that time, and there was no one. I thought, well, I have to put a running order. There was nothing that was like the one before. I mean, they were so wildly different. I thought, this is the craziest career anybody could possibly have. Who is this person? It was me, you know. But it was like rampant eclecticism. It was like a completely different voice, and I just thought, my God, it was like watching a chameleon. You know, it was like watching a chameleon just change colors. So I thought, no wonder my audience got confused. I confused myself. I mean, I was only doing one thing at a time, so it seemed like I was doing it for a really long time. But then I would listen back to earlier things and say, oh, boy, I really had to move on from that. You know, it's a good thing I moved on from that. I didn't want to stay there. So.
Well, it's kind of jumping ahead, but I remember when you came out with Canciones de mi Padre.
De mi Padre, yeah.
I I didn't know until then that you were
Mexican. I'm a Mexican.
I mean, I was German Irish. I thought you were one of me.
Well, I'm that too. But I'm Dutch on both sides, so I've got a lot of Dutch. My great grandmother was Basque. And, there's definitely some Germans in there. My grandfather, my great grandfather was born in Germany. So, and then some Spanish and some Native American on both sides. So I just figure I can get any scholarship. Not that I ever went to school. I couldn't stand still for that either.
Yeah. So you sang a great deal as a child with your family. Your father had a tremendous voice, didn't he?
He had a beautiful voice. You know, probably the best voice in the family. And everybody loved him when he sang. And he wouldn't stand up and go, listen to me sing. It would just happen. We'd be riding in the car and he'd start singing. Somebody might start singing a harmony. Somebody else start singing a third part. Or we'd be at the dinner table, you know, and my father would just start singing. We weren't allowed to read at the dinner table, but we were allowed to sing. Couldn't bring a magazine, but you could sing all you wanted.
That's really neat.
It was neat.
It's like...
And my father would call me up on the phone and he'd start singing something, you know. And I'd sing with him on the other, you know, somebody would hear me just sing this harmony to nothing. And the other person that I do that with a lot is Emmy Lou Harris. She and I sing stuff together. McGarrigle sister songs usually, which we love wildly, the McGarrigles, which was a duet, you know. And she'd say, I heard this, the new record, the new McGarrigle record is out, and it goes like this, blah, and I'd start singing the harmony because I'd already have the record. You know, it's so nice to have a friend like that that understands that you need to sing over the phone together. That's a good friend.
So you, after a brief, one semester in college? Maybe.
I went one semester.
Yeah. You packed up.
That's all they could stand of me. You know what I would do? I would get up in the morning. Well, I would be working at some club the night before, and I would stay out till all godly hours, you know. And I'd go to sleep for about 5 minutes. And I had the 7:40 class that was, I can't remember what it was, something really, really, it was an anthropology class, which I'm interested in. But it was taught by this teaching assistant. It was 1,500 people in there. It was in the dark, and this guy would be droning on and on, you know. It was just awful. It was like abuse. So I'd have to get up, you know, at 5:30 in the morning to get to the 7:40 class. And I was always too tired. I'd get up at the last minute. So I'd put my coat on over my flannel nightgown because it's cold in the desert. And I'd get there, and I'd fall asleep in the 7:40 class because the guy was up there droning on and on. And then I would go out, and I'd forget where I parked the car because I was so sleepy. By that time, the sun was up in the desert, so it would go from 38 to 78. You know, that would be the temperature spread. So it would be like in my hot, sweaty nightgown, I'd be afraid to take my coat off because there I'd be in my nightgown, you know. And I couldn't find the car anywhere. So I just figured I wasn't cut out for college. I like reading, and so I just read a lot of books, but I didn't go to the class.
So you just announced to your parents that you were moving to L.A. and left.
Yeah, well, they were sad, you know. My mother cried, and my father said, you know, you're making a big mistake. And I said, well, I just have to go. There are not enough good clubs in Tucson to play in, you know. And, I mean, that's what I meant. There were, you know, Tucson was a hard sell for music. Now, Tucson had a great music history from the early days before there was a radio. There was a good musical community there. And because my grandfather was the conductor of the band, of the kind of the oompa band that played all the military affairs and played serenades and whatever you wanted music for, you had to call my grandfather because he was a rancher, but he conducted the band, taught everybody how to play their instruments, just like the music man, except he really knew how to play. So anyway, it was very musical up until then. And my aunt, Louisa, was a big star in the 20s. She was a very well-known singer then. She went to Spain and collected a lot of traditional Spanish folk songs and dances. And she also went to northern Mexico and collected a lot of stuff in the Altar Valley there. She was a scholar eventually after she was not a performer anymore. She became a scholar, but of that musical history.
She the one who brought Segovia?
She sent this letter to my, we have this, it's in the Arizona Historical Society now, this letter lives there, but she sent this letter home to my grandfather saying, this was in the 20s, saying she'd met this guitar player, and he was such a good guitar player that he could hold the audience when she went off to change her dance costume and come back on the stage. And she really wanted to bring him to the United States because she was sure he'd be a hit, and it was Andres Segovia, that he was her Eagles. You know, that's her version of the Eagles. It's a Ronstadt tradition. You get somebody, you hire somebody to be your backup person, it's going to become a way bigger star than you'll ever dream of being, you know?
Yes, this is, my husband was stunned to learn that the Eagles were
your backup band. They were great guys.
What kind of, you know, credential is that? The Eagles. It's like having the Beatles for your opening act.
Yeah, they were good.
They still are.
I put them together. They were really good.
So, reading about that early time in Los Angeles and all of the folks who came together there, that just must have been an astonishing community.
Well, we didn't know that. You know, we were just like looking around, like you're just trying to get that song. You know, you're trying to write that song or learn that song or get somebody else who wrote that song, let you record it before they did. You know, that's what I mainly was doing. And we were just together all the time hanging out playing. And we didn't think of it in terms of, oh, there's Jackson Browne, he's a star, you know. It's just Jackson Browne was this 16-year-old kid that I met when I was 17. And I thought he wrote really good songs, for instance, better than any of the people that I heard writing songs in Tucson. You know, oh, California, they write some pretty good songs over here. And the next person that I met was Ry Cooder. And I said, oh, they got some pretty good guitar players. So Ry was, you know, 18. And he was playing like a demon, you know, like, you know, fire would come out of his fingers. He and Taj Mahal had a band called the Rising Suns, and I went and heard them, and I went, well, they got some good players here, you know, so I stayed. I could learn.
It was hard for me to follow the story of the book through that part, because every time one of those names jumped out, all of the music would come back, and I'd be going to look, you mentioned Jackson Browne These Days, and I had to go online and get that, I had to hear it again.
A beautiful song.
It is a beautiful song.
Well,
one of my favorite.
Really beautiful crafting. You know, he's a very, very fine songwriter who still writes at the top of his talent. He hasn't had one of those things where he Jackson got up here and he just kind of kept going up.
He was here this spring with Emmylou and Joan Baez.
I saw it. I was here.
Oh, were you?
In his theater?
No, it was downtown.
Oh.
It was at the Civic, but it was in San Jose.
Yeah, I saw that concert.
Yeah. Oh, were you? Oh,
Jackson sang his ass off.
They were fabulous.
Oh, man. And Joan was flirting with him. You know, she was shameless. I was just like talking about kissing his lips and kissing him. Oh, man. You know, if it was a guy, you go, that's sexual harassment. Come on, back off a little bit. But she was after him. I got to give her a little high five after that. He's so cute, you know. Jackson's, I noticed he was cute when he was 16. I never didn't notice it.
Well, The creative threads that go through this book are just astonishing to me, the way you do move from style to style. And you mentioned a number of times I have to learn a song. Now, for me, when I have to learn it, it means I have to memorize the words because the music is hopeless for me.
It takes a long time to learn it.
But,
you know?
But what is there to learning the music of a song?
Well, there's something that, what usually attracts me about a song, it'll be something in the chords, you know. There'll be the way the chords are voiced. They just kind of reach in and grab your heart and kind of rip on one of the ventricles so that it causes really severe pain. You have to go to the emergency hospital. It's like that. It's like, ow, that really hurt. Play it again, you know. And it's just, it really disturbs me. It's like it gives me a stomach ache. Jimmy Webb's songs infallibly give me a stomach ache. They upset my stomach. I have to listen to them some more so that I get really sick and throw up. So I like them so much. But it seems perverse, but it just is. There's something in the chords, and then there's something maybe in a word, you know, like a phrase. I go, oh, I felt like that. You know, that's exactly the way I felt, but I couldn't quite say it. Or it will say to me, I didn't realize I felt like that. You know, I didn't realize I was quite so sad about that situation. That it was just kind of, and so you sing it for a while and you learn it, and 3 or 4 years later you're singing it on stage, and that situation is gone, and you don't even give a flying, you know, anything about that situation. And then you go, it was so too bad that I went to the market today looking for bread and butter pickles, which are kind of a Midwest phenomenon. Yeah. They didn't have any. And I really feel bad because I want to make a pickle and cheese sandwich and there were no bread and butter pickles. And that's what that becomes about, you know, just while you're on stage at that. I mean, really, it just changes. It's like a kaleidoscope of, you know, people say, oh, you were singing and standing on stage. You're remembering that guy that broke your heart in 1968. You know, I go, I forgot about him forever. I can't even remember his name, you know, or care. So, but the pickle, the bread and butter pickles, that's important. That stays with you.
We talked a little bit backstage, and I asked Linda if she would read just a few lines from her book that I think are a lovely expression of the creative spirit. You think you can?
Yeah.
Oh, good. You found your glasses.
My glasses.
Great glasses, by the way.
Thank you. I closed up my New York apartment, put it on the market, and returned to the West Coast. The idea of a Mexican record was fully present in my dreams at night. The dream world of sleep and the dream world of music are not far apart. I often catch glimpses of one as I pass through a door to the other, like encountering a neighbor in the hallway going into the apartment next to one's own. In the recording studio, I would often lie down to nap and wake up with harmony parts fully formed in my mind, ready to be recorded. I think of music as dreaming in sound.
I think of music as dreaming and sound is a line that I will always remember from that book.
Thank you.
It's just really lovely. How many songs did you actually write?
Were
you?
Not very many. I only recorded two. I wrote more than I recorded, but I'm not going to admit to any of them. I'm not going to sing them for you up here. I wrote a song called Try Me Again, which I gave Andrew Gold half credit for, but he didn't.
Yeah, it's a great song.
And I wrote a half of Winter Light with Eric Kaz. We wrote it for a movie, and then it went on a couple of my records. It turned out to be a nice track. It was nice.
It's at the time, you were a little unusual in my music universe in that most of the people who were prominent at that time were writing and singing their own material.
Well, I just used the ones they didn't use up. You know, there were that plenty left over.
Well,
I was happy to have them.
Of course, you also had a voice. I mean, like Bob Dylan did not have a voice.
Well, Bob Dylan, please forget it. I mean, he's a great singer. He has plenty of voice. He has a very, very wonderful resonant voice with lots of rich story and lots of tones, and he's a really fine musician. You don't get that good and not be a great musician. Yeah. He's a really good guitar player. He's an excellent singer. He's very in tune. He just has a different, he's a completely original sounding singer. That's hard to do, you know, that's hard to be. Yeah. I've had this argument with myself about Bob Dylan. I say, I didn't sing as good as Otis Redding. Well, guess what? He was Bob Dylan. Why should he sing like Otis Redding?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you just, but he's, you can't, you have to give him his due. What was the question you asked me? I forgot. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, you know, it was unusual. I mean, the 70s was a phenomenon of the singer-songwriter. But what would happen is you'd get somebody that would spend his whole life, you know, having experiences and writing, you know, 12 songs that he could then record. And he'd take his 12 best ones that he had or his 10 best ones that he had. And then that was it. Then he'd have to wait another lifetime to get another collection of songs. Yeah. And it was just trying to play catch-up. Poor James Taylor would get this look on his face like, oh, I've got to put another record, 10 songs, you know. I got writer's block, I can't write. Who needs that, you know? He finally figured out he could record some other things, too. He interprets other people's things beautifully. But Ella Fitzgerald never worried if she wrote a song.
Yeah.
She never cared. Billie Holiday, she could have cared less she wrote a song. She wrote a good song. She wrote Strange Fruit.
Yeah.
But still, she didn't, every time she wanted to make a record, she didn't have to think about it. I had to think about just exactly how to ask J.D. or Jackson, one of those guys, can I please record that song? And they go, no, I mean, well, record. You know, I'm not going to let you have it until next year. Okay. It was like that. And sometimes I take their hands and put them in the Cuisinart and turn on the air. Getting that song out, you know. Give me that song. I would stalk that song. I found a tape of me and Jackson Brown having this conversation where I was trying to get one of his songs, and he gave me one of Warren Zevon's songs instead because he was working with Warren Zevon. It was Poor Pitiful Me.
Mm.
So that worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
And J.D., the same night I was trying to talk J.D. into giving me this song called Last in Love. And he said, oh, why don't you sing this song, Blue Bayou? I've got all this on tape. So I have to put it on somebody's website. I have no website, but I'll have to put it on somebody's website. Maybe the publisher has a website. I can put it on there.
Speaking of websites, the industry is so different today from when you started.
It's unrecognizable, you know.
Yeah. You had to deal with record companies and things like that, but you also got a lot of things done for you.
Well, they were gatekeepers, you know. It was just like the news. I mean, what do we do if we don't have the New York Times to be fact checkers? I mean, we used to have a local paper, you know, that had their own fact checkers. You guys have the San Jose Mercury News, right?
Right.
It's one of the last broadsheets left standing. Who knows if it'll ever survive? And yeah. It's a very worthy paper and should survive. You know, because all of the news shouldn't come out of New York. I mean, I happen to read the New York Times. I have for years, but I used to live in New York, and I just got in the habit and didn't get out of it. But, you know, it's just like when the radio stations changed. Radio used to be local. You had the local disc jockey that would tell about local issues and give out local dedications. You remember you could call in and have dedications? Well, now it's all done out of Chicago or Boston. And if there were a fire, you'd run to the radio station and say, tell everybody there's a fire, tell everybody there's a flood coming, and the dam broke, mm-hmm. and there's a big wall of water coming. You run down there, there'd be some robot in there, you know, yeah. transmitting this broadcast that came from Chicago. It's dangerous. Yeah. You guys still have some local radio in San Jose. In San Francisco, I listen to the Mexican station from San Jose because it's really subversive and good. I love it.
Huh.
It tells everybody where the migra is, you know, where they're raiding and, you know, don't go over this way. And I love it. And they play that gnarly narco corrido stuff, which, you know, I'm sorry. I know it's bad to glorify drugs, and I'm not a druggie. I'm really the worst. Can't drink. I'm hopeless, you know. Take one joint and you smoke one hit on you, like, ugh, I can't remember the sins at the end of the sins. You know, it's terrible. So I don't bother with it. But the weird thing is that that music, the narco corridos, have the most vitality in it. So that apparently is where all the... where the economy is sitting. And of course, ask anybody at a bank, like the Bank of America, they're all laundering all that drug money, and so they're making fortunes of money. The drug companies don't want marijuana legal because it will compete with them, and they're making a lot of money. You know, everybody's getting rich off of marijuana being illegal. But it's interesting that music has so much vitality. It's so wonderful. And American pop music is a little bit these days. It's a little saggy. Because there aren't any these gatekeepers, you know. I mean, it's kind of great that anybody can make a record. You've got a laptop. You know how to get work Pro Tools. You can kind of figure it out. But everybody can make a record then. And then there's just such a huge amount of stuff out there that it's like just getting hit by a tsunami of music, and you can't choose.
Do you think, how would you have dealt with that?
I just don't know. You know, I have no idea. I mean, I think you do the same thing you always do. You find a way to get in front of an audience and you start singing about stuff, and it either resonates with people or it doesn't. But it's harder. I mean, in these shows, people say, you know, there's like American Idol, is that what it is? Which is a show I've never to this day seen. If there is a heaven, I don't believe in anything until it's dark, then I believe in everything. But if there's a heaven, I'm going to get up there and go, I never saw American Idol one time. They're going to come on in, you know.
Yeah.
Never seen it. But I have had it described to me. And when you pit people against each other, it's like pit bulls. You know, like you do that with dogs. It's not good. It's a bad thing. People say, stop that, put a law against it. I think you should stop pitting singers against each other, because art is not about competition. It's about cooperation.
Yeah.
You know, art is a conspiracy. I'm very fond of using this expression to educators particularly, but conspiros, the word conspiros means to breathe together. It comes from the Latin word conspiros, because spiro is spirit. So you breathe together. So when you're singing together, like when you're in a choir or singing in parts or singing a duet, you're forming a conspiracy to commit beauty, you know, to commit understanding and commit revelation and all these wonderful things that happen. Commit magic. That's what you do with music. So to you know, have people dressed up. And what would you do with a guy like Bob Dylan on American Idol?
Yeah.
How about Leonard Cohen?
Yeah.
You get Leonard Cohen on American Idol, he's like,
yeah.
He's so good. He's the best of them all, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Lovely. Wonderful.
So we have a question from the audience, from Igloria, who says, I learned so much from you about singing. She says, what has been your most challenging project and why?
Well, they were the ones I failed utterly, you know. You didn't get to hear a lot of those.
I didn't do so well singing
real true opera. I didn't have the training for it. I went and sang Bohème. I sang Mimi and Bohème. And it was great fun, and I loved learning the part, and I loved the part, and I loved the opera. And it was great for me because I got to learn it in a way that you don't learn it unless you learn to sing it. It's a very intimate relationship that you have with music that you've learned. But I just didn't do it well enough, you know. And so I sang it for a while, and then I came home. And now I go hear somebody else sing it, and I go, wow, I know this girl, you know. I know this girl really well, this girl Mimi. And the other people that come on the stage, they're like old friends.
Yeah.
It's really good. So it was a great experience for me, but I don't know if it's so good for the audience. And they had to pay.
So tell us about one that was extremely challenging. I'm going to
guess.
Which one? Tell us about what you think was perhaps your most challenging success.
Well, the standards were really hard. The thing about the standards is they've got to sound like easy. It's got to just sound like just completely easy.
Yep.
And they're so hard. There's no room for forgiveness. You can't be an inch out of tune. Your voice is completely exposed. You got to be able to hold that note with no vibrato. You know, you just got to have precision singing. I used to try to think of myself in an elevator going up to the, right up to that note, you know, get out of that floor. But it was really hard, but it was worth it. When it became where you could get it, it was ecstatic singing. And I got to where I was just singing and I wasn't thinking at all. I was just swimming around, you know. I used to say it felt like I was swimming in cream, but that's what it felt like. The first time I ever started singing with Nelson Riddle in the orchestra, I just went, this is it, man. This is heaven. This is as good as it gets. And then the Mexican stuff, which was very, very difficult to learn at a professional level, because I'd sung it with my family, and we, you know, the first, que lejos estoy del suelo, you know, I can't remember the rest of the song, you know, I can't remember the rest of the verse, but somebody else would, a cousin would put it in or something. But you can't do that when you're up on the stage singing professionally. You have to know all the words. And you have to know them. It was really hard. The first show I did, it was so hard to learn all that stuff in Spanish, and I was really nervous. And when you're nervous, your mind just goes blank. And we didn't have those monitors yet that have the, you know, we used to have it lately. We had a TV monitor with the lyrics, but this is before they invented them. So I tried, there were a couple of songs I didn't know, and I had a fan, you know. I had this really nice costume with a fan, so I put the words on the fan. But I can't see without my glasses. So I was looking. It was hopeless, you know. I couldn't see. I didn't know the words. I was just like that. It was bad.
Another fan asks, first, thank you for all your music. You did such a good job in Pirates. Why didn't you do anything like that again in acting? You were a good actress.
I wasn't such a good actress. I was singing, so it didn't occur to me that I was acting. I don't know anything about the craft. Acting is really hard. I mean, again, to give those people, we have actors now that are just magicians, you know. I wish we had corporate heads of movie companies that had half the skill that those actors have, because the actors are always better than the movies these days. But, you know, I just didn't know very much about that. And also, I didn't want to be stuck singing one part of my voice, you know. Once I got that high part of my voice, I went, oh, I can do that. But when I started learning standards, I learned that I could take that high part of my voice and marry it to the belt part of my voice. And then I got the standards voice. That's what created that voice, you know. And as soon as I got that, I went, oh, I like this. It's like swimming in silk. It was just so much fun to sing.
Yeah.
And then after that, I did the Mexican music. That gave me a really good support for the Mexican music. Because the Mexican music is a lot of going from chest voice into head, and you have to have a real smooth, real clear channel to get from one to the other, you know. So it really helped me. And then learning the Mexican music really prepared me for going back to American pop music, because learning those rhythms was so hard. The Mexican rhythms are so difficult that anything they ever have in rock and roll is a cinch after that, you know. So, and a lot of rock and roll, like the stuff that came up from New Orleans, is all based on the 5-beat on the clave on West African. It's like, everything that comes out of New Orleans has that beat under it. And all of the East Coast of Mexico, all that music that's on the along the coast, along the beach, all that tropical music, that's all 5-beat. That's all West African 5-beat. Whereas the huapangos that I love so much are based on indigenous Mexican rhythms that are not anything like West Africa. They're just impossible to figure out. I had had my own way of counting with, you know, using alphabet and numbers and everything. I get the colors, you know. I try to figure out a way how to count my way through those passages. That was the hardest. Musically, those were the most challenging of anything I ever did.
Another audience member asks, in addition to Lola Beltran, were you also influenced by Lucho Moreno? in mariachi. Lucha, L-U-C-H-A?
Lucha?
Lucha Moreno.
I never heard of her. Who?
Lucha.
Lucha, yeah. It was Lucha Reyes. I was very influenced by her. She was the first Lucha that I know of. She was fantastic. When she starts to sing, I cry. But immediately started. She was the big influence for Lola Beltran. But Lola Beltran, she was the one, you know, I really tried to copy her from the time that I was about seven. The voice I tried to copy for rock and roll, you know. And it's a different rhythm. I had always had a hard time with phrasing in American rock and roll because I was trying to be a Mexican. I was succeeding being a Mexican. I'm a good Mexican, you know, because I got it in my genes. But it was hard to get that married to American rock and roll.
Is there anything in your career that you would do differently if you had it to do over?
Well, I would have learned a lot of things. I would have studied a lot more. I would have just absolutely sat down and learned to read music. I couldn't learn to read music, so I went to do Boheme. I had to learn it in Italian off the record and then relearn it in English because they insisted on doing it in English. That was hard. It would have been just much easier to take that shortcut and just learn to read those notes. But and it would have been easier communicating with the band, too, because I could have said, you know, I knew some music to communicate with them, but it would have been a lot faster and a lot easier if I could have read. I could have written them a chart, you know, yeah. Because a lot of the arrangement ideas were mine. I'd have to sing them, you know, to the guitar player. I'd be going, wee, 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 you know. And they'd be going, oh, I sound so bad being a guitar.
Yeah.
But I could tell, I could communicate what I wanted, but I would have done that. I would have studied languages. I mean, languages are a cinch for me. I have a good ear. I wish I had learned German and Italian. I studied Italian. I was fluent in Italian at some point, you know, from Berlitz. I mean, I could go buy a skirt and a pair of pants and a purse or something like that. And I could say a couple of sentences or a paragraph. But I couldn't tell about anything complex.
Yeah.
I couldn't discuss any philosophy with my vocabulary.
Did you learn Italian just being there? Or did you
Berlitz. I went to Berlitz. I just loved it. Well, I figured I'd need it. I went to Italy, and I liked it so much. I said, I'm going back to Italy. I'm going to be able to talk. So that started it. But then I got the job to do Boheme. So then I needed to really work on Italian so that I could learn it, you know. But even though I was saying it in English. Yeah. But I had to learn it off the... There were only recordings of it in Italian, and I had to learn it.
Yeah.
So I worked on Italian really hard. But I wish I had just started that when I was, you know, seven. Just a lot of languages. Everybody, like, you should approach it like a geisha. You know, a geisha is really exquisitely trained in dancing, calligraphy, acting, singing, playing an instrument. They have to be able to know how to do those things. And they have to be able to act beautiful, whether they're beautiful or not. They have to be able to stand in front of somebody and convince them that they're absolutely gorgeous and then be able to take it away if they want to, because sometimes being beautiful can be a problem, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that everyone who's an artist should be trained like a geisha. Like a real geisha.
You have worked to try to get music back into the schools. I know you testified before Congress.
I'd like to just get education back into schools. Yeah. You know? You got these people, they want you to just go and take a test. They don't want to teach you anything. They just want you to take a test. They want to teach you how to take a test, you know. And it's just and it's like a war on public education. You know, I think these corporations think that they can just support this other idea, and then eventually everybody, like Mitt Romney, saying, "Well, you just go to private school, yeah, for $100,000 a year, $50,000 a year. You know, if you can spare that out of your pin money." So it's just an outrage. You know, we're losing the best things. We used to have a model public education system in this country, and it's gone.
Yeah. And are you still active at all in trying to push that?
Well, you know, I try to give support. Like, there's this group called the Los Ensondles. They have a little cultural center in Richmond over in the East Bay. And this guy, Eugene Rodriguez, is just brilliant. He does it all by himself with his family. It's a family endeavor. He's a master's level guitar player. He's got a master's in music. And his wife is a fully trained Montessori teacher, and her mother's a fully trained Waldorf teacher. And these people know how to teach kids. They know how to be respectful of kids. And they teach them, you know, music isn't slow. It's not something you learn instantly. You can't learn it overnight. You can't learn it in 3 days. You can't learn it in 3 months. It takes year after year, hour after hour, week after week, day after day. You know, it just takes a long time to learn music. And music, especially traditional music, I think should never be separated from dancing. Because they keep each other, you know, if you take dance music and you don't have dancers there, it's like bluegrass. It just gets faster and faster and faster, and pretty soon nobody can stand it. It just sounds like hammers on your ears, you know. And it's the same way with Mexican music. It's made as a dance music. Even there's even certain kinds of music that are made for an equestrian beat. Like there's a middle part in Carmen where they're showing, you know, or before when Carmen, the opera Carmen, when they go into the bull ring because she has an affair with a bullfighter. And it's this big, long piece of music. And when I hear it, when the orchestras do it, I'll say, it's too fast, slow down, because it's really supposed to be about this sort of pageantry where they're parading around on horseback before the bullfight. And if you get it to that rhythm, to a slow canter, it has a beautiful swing to it, and it's much better groove, and it's a much more hypnotic piece of music. So there are those kinds of things. Where does this music come from? What was its intended purpose? You know, it's like trying to make a hound out of a sheepdog. You can't change their purpose. So you need to know where it came from. So if kids are, like the Sansonelis, they teach them really how to sing, really how to dance, and really how to play an instrument. And his wife, Astrid, you know, who's the Montessori teacher, really is a wonderful artist. Art just drips out of her hands. And she teaches the kids really how to make beautiful visual art. And you go in there, and they've made a Day of the Dead altar, and it's a pretty rusty neighborhood over there. I mean, it's funky. And she really encourages the kids to put their stories in, and say, well, tell me about, you know, some 6-year-old or 8-year-old, you know, just made a Day of the Dead altar. Tell me about your Day of the Dead altar. Well, somebody came in and shot Uncle Louie. We were having pizza. And somebody came in with a gun and shot him, and somebody killed him. You know, so, and you look at that, and I go, oh, you know, it's just like a 10-year-old telling me this. Yeah. And I go, oh, let's look at this. And you see, they put it all into the Day of the Dead altar, you know. It doesn't mean that they're over that problem. It doesn't mean they have closure, whatever that's supposed to mean. It means they actually got to express it and somebody heard them. You know, not everybody has that story, but a lot of those kids do have stories like that. And there was a murder and a rape of a middle school child, a middle school girl that was friends with a lot of the people that were in the Sansonelis. And they brought in grief counselors to the school. Well, Eugene thought, what's in our culture that would be ordinarily there? What you would use a corrido, because that's a story song and it tells the story of whatever horrible thing happened. So he got the kids to sit down, you know, these middle school kids, and write about their friend that just died that they loved. Their friend was taken from them, and their cousin or their sister, whoever it was. And they wrote, you know, like a 20-verse corrido. Hmm. And then along came the guy from Arjuli Records, the president of Arjuli Records, and he recorded it. He validated their feelings, you know, he validated their story. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing they were recording, then they added recording to what they did. So now those kids over there, they learn to sing, dance, play instruments, do visual art, and record. You know, it's really, and they learn video. They get a comprehensive thing over there. They don't necessarily come out of there. It's not an artist training school. It's not for performing arts. It's for kids to learn how to use music in the most organic way that it is, which is to socialize, to tell your story, to express your sorrows and your joys. And those kids have a tremendous high level of going to college, finishing high school, going to college, lessons, teen pregnancy. It does all kinds of wonderful stuff, you know. And it gives them a place to hang out after school. They got somebody to be. They don't have to get tattooed saying, you know, I have no self. You know, it's like the first tattoo everybody should get should say, I have no sense of who I am, so I'm getting this tattoo. I'm inherently an unstable person because I don't know who I am. You know, my son is covered with them. I'm just going, are you crazy? He's got fish jumping out of his collar and a big eyeball tattooed on his Adam's apple. I'm going, oh, you're going to have a lot of fun getting that removed when you're 24. You know, whatever.
It's, the studies will show that the arts are much better than sports for teaching teamwork.
And, oh, yeah. And, you learn way more teamwork from playing music than you do from...
Except
like
on American
football.
Idol.
I mean, that's really good for you. Get your head slammed. You know, your brain is slamming around in there. You're getting a concussion. You're going to be, you know, have probably with maybe violence or your memory by the time you're 30. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. And for what? At the end of it, you haven't cured cancer. You know, you haven't learned a new language. You don't even dance. You just run this ball around the field. I really hate football. It should be really abolished. It's immoral. I don't have any opinions or anything.
My husband listening down there.
Football is wrong.
We should talk a little bit about Parkinson's.
Okay.
Many people admire you for dealing with it. So
well, I mean, I don't have any choice, you know. It's not like I had much of a choice, you know. It's like I was very surprised when I got that diagnosis. I went to the doctor and I said, you know, keep dropping things. And I had some operation on my shoulders, and I thought it was because of that. I couldn't believe it when he told me what it had. And then I had to go home and look it up and find out what it was, you know, and that really sent me right to the floor. And then after that, you just get up and go, okay, well, today's a day, and I can still walk. You know, in the morning I wake up and I say, I can still walk and I can still talk. That's good. Yeah. You know, and I do physical therapy. That helps. Doesn't take it away. But it makes it so that I can put one foot in front of the other for a while.
Now that you're not doing music in the same way, how do you bring harmony into your life?
Well, it's hard. Music, that was a very cruel blow, you know, because even if I weren't performing, most of people's music is private. Like most of the music that I did was, you know, singing in the elevator, my hands in the dishwater, in the shower, or whatever, you know, I was driving along, yeah. I'd sang all the time. You know, just a little tiny bit of it was on stage. So I miss all of that. It's very boring not to be able to sing. But I do a lot of whistling. It's not quite the same, but it's something. Whistle around.
And what is the greatest joy in your life now, one of our success?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. I mean, when my kids are happy and productive, that's a great thing. I think everybody feels that way about their children. I like to go over and hear the Sensuan list and see what they're up to. And I mean, that is just thrills me because even though I'm not doing it, but, you know, poor Eugene Rodriguez is working away and there's only one of him and it spreads himself pretty thin. But every once in a while I try to go over and just try to give him something to lean on. You know, I don't know if it's how effective it is. I love it when kids really get that aha moment. They say, this is what music's for. It's not to make you a star. It's not to get you on TV. It's not to make you any money. It's like you go over to your friend's house and they say, come on, let's dance. And you do a little dancing, you know, and then you stop for a while or you play guitars together for a little while or you sing some harmonies or you maybe write a song together about something that happened to you last week. That's what it's for. You know, there's a tiny, tiny percentage of it that might go on to become a performer and be a hero, you know, but it's such a tiny percentage. They shouldn't even think of it. They should just think of doing it for joy. And for transcendence. You know, that's what you should get out of art is transcendence.
I think they're coming after us.
Just
the hook?
Got the hook.
A little note that we have 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And for maybe a couple more questions.
All righty.
Thank you. Well, for these kids or anyone else who's inspired, we have a couple of folks who've asked, what advice would you give to a young aspiring artist today, given the very different world?
Well, you know, again, when people come to me and they say, I want to be a star. Can you tell me how to be a star? I say, I just can't help you, you know. When somebody comes to me and says, I want to make music, I go, okay, I can help you there, you know. As long as you with doing something like that, you have to do it kind of with no expectation. You have to be ambitious for the music. And then it depends on, you know, then I can usually tell pretty fast whether somebody's really going to be any good or not, you know, but it doesn't matter if you're not good. You should still be able to do it. I think everybody should do their own dancing and their own singing. But what I usually tell people is just to get, you know, to get your music together. You have to have a real clear picture of what it is. You have to be able to get it together, get your band together if somebody's going to accompany you or learn an instrument so you can accompany yourself if you're going to sing. You can't just sort of show up and say, I sing, so put something together behind me, you know. It isn't like that. Those people, even Britney Spears, you know, she's got some talent. She's got some ideas about what she wants to do. It looks like everything is just sort of fixed for her, and maybe they do some fixing. I don't really know. I don't know her career that well, but I just know that nobody really makes it unless they have a clear idea of what they want to do. And so then I usually tell people just make it as clear as possible. You know, don't, you know, you just have to make your story as clear as you can. And if it resonates to the rest of the audience, the rest of the people that come to hear you, then you have a career. Otherwise, you have to get some kind of a job that will support you. And you can do your music as much as you want, but it doesn't mean you have to stop doing music.
Is there anyone through your life that you've mentored, a younger artist? Most of the books seem to be contemporaries and learning. I have a sense that you were learning your way through the book rather than...
Well, we mentored each other. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, running into somebody like Emmylou Harris... was nobody trying to do country music. Nobody. I mean, country rock, you know. And Emmy, she got it. You know, she was trying to do it too. And we heard about each other. We were way on opposite sides of the country, but we heard about each other from Chris Hillman. And I was so delighted when I heard her. I mean, first I got jealous, you know, because she's really good. And I went, oh my God, she can sing better than I can, and she's doing what I want to do, and she's really pretty, and she's up there. And then I went, I can get jealous, or I can just love her singing. And if I love her singing, I might be able to sing with her. So I made that choice. It was a split-second choice, but I made that choice to not get jealous. You know, it's that thing, instead of competing, cooperate. It always gets you farther. So I went, and I met her, and we became really good friends right away. And we sang together for a lot, you know.
And Dolly Parton.
And same, you know, I saw Dolly standing. I mean, she was really something. She was so beautiful. Dolly's one of those people who wears a whole bunch of makeup. You wash it all off, you just find the most beautiful porcelain. It's like an English rose, you know. Mm. Like legendary skin texture that's so beautiful. And she's these huge eyes that are just aquamarine blue. And she's just got this smile that just goes on forever and beautiful lips. And she had on this big dress, you know, with a lot of petticoats. It was sticking out that far. And she was up on stage just singing her ass off. Like, I just never heard anybody sing like that. It's like a mountain stream. It sounded like water tripping over the stones, you know. She's very musical. She's very talented. And she has this gorgeous voice. So I was just like, and she said, don't think I'm a dumb country girl just because of the way I'm dressed or something like that. Hadn't occurred to me, you know, never entered my mind. I was going, how could she sing like that? You know, she sings all these little ribbon bow embellishments, and what they really are is they're like, you know, stuff from the Middle Ages that just got frozen in the Appalachian Mountains. I mean, there's just ancient, old British ballads and this old turns of phrase, you know, that she would use that were these antique things that are just beautiful. It only happened there and someplace in England where they're still frozen there, you know. But she's saying all these beautiful little curly cues on her singing. I just never heard embellishments like that. You know, it's just beautiful singing and real strong story. Dolly had she had a hard life growing up. It was a lot of poverty. It was really hard for her to grow up. So she tells all about it in her music, you know. It was good.
So we're sitting here in Santa Clara University, a Jesuit school that has educated many prominent people. People in government, for instance, some governors.
Some Jesuit governors.
I'm speaking, of course, of Janet Napolitano, who's a proud...
If he'd been a Franciscan, I probably never would have gone out with him. Jesuit thing gave him the edge, that's for sure. Especially to a Basque. The people that founded the Jesuits were the man that found Ignatius Loyola, Jesuit, what was his name? Ignatius Loyola?
Loyola, the guy, yes.
Yeah. He was a Basque. Probably related to me. I don't know.
I used to
tease Jerry because he had only one governor in his background, and I had two in mine. Zamorano and Arguello. They were both governors, and I'm directly descended from both of them. So Governor Zamorano and Governor Arguello, which they call Arguello in San Francisco, but we still call it Arguello because it was our grandfather.
Well, I have to say, I cannot, in one sense, imagine you as First Lady of California.
No, I couldn't. It wasn't going for that.
But it sure would be fun.
I recorded a couple of songs. Like, early in my career, I recorded a song called I Never Will Marry. And then later in my career, I recorded another song called Never Will I Marry. It was kind of like a hint.
Yeah.
It was a big indication of what was going to go on in between there, those two places.
And I have to say, in hearing, you know, ages ago, it was back east, about you and Jerry, I kept, different drum kept coming to mind, you know.
Well, I recorded that way before I met him.
Well, how are we for time?
He's
are
a good
we...
guy, though. I mean, honestly, if you want to know about Jerry, you got to ask his wife, Ann, because she's the one that has more. And I went out with him 40 years ago, yeah. You know. So, and he was at my house Christmas Eve, but with his wife, Ann, who's just a really nice person. You would like her so much if you haven't
she
met
her. She is delightful.
She's adorable, and she's really nice to Jerry. That's the good part.
And he actually—he really seems to be in love. It's
he really
he
is.
Talks about him. It's very nice. Is there anything you would like to leave us with?
Nothing I can think of. Maybe I've talked enough tonight. My God.
Let me ask you then one final question that someone from the audience wanted to ask, and that is, if you could turn back time. Is there anyone you would like to have performed with that you didn't? And I have to say, if you've read the book, you know she's already performed with just about everybody.
Well, I would like to. I sang a duet with Frank Sinatra, but it was after, really, he couldn't sing anymore. I wish we could have sung together when he still had a healthy voice. That would have been cool, you know. I would have liked that.
Yeah.
And the other guy is David Hidalgo. I wanted to sing with him really badly. Oh, I had such a crush on him the first time I saw the Lobos, and I went, oh, my God, you know, he's so cute. And he's so shy that he'd go to say, hi, how are you doing, man? He never took his eyes off the ground, you know, he's just looking at the ground. But we finally got to sing together, but by the time we did, my voice was pretty much gone, you know. It wasn't. We talked about doing an album together, and that's the fish that got away from me. I love him. I love those guys. I love he has a completely unique guitar style. I love his singing. I love his songwriting.
Mm-hmm. How hard was it to transition when you adopted your children, to sort of transition out of the limelight and go back to everyday life?
Because I never was invested in that, you know. It was just that thing that I did in that tiny little percentage of my day was on stage. The rest of it was dealing with all the stuff that everybody else deals with. Mm-hmm. And I never was too happy on stage. You know, I was always pretty glad when the show was over.
Hmm.
I like singing, but I don't like performing so much.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Well, I don't know a lot of people that like performing. I don't know. Some people do, but mostly it's just a kind of, you know, it's not a natural, like in the animal kingdom, if an animal's staring at you, it's usually getting ready to eat you. You know, we have those instincts. So I look out, I see lions and tigers out there, you know, it's like, oh, they're staring at me. Better run. Might be a bear in the front row there.
But I would have thought, I mean, actors talk about what they get back from an audience, and maybe it's different performing music, but the artists that I've, you know, spoken to in the past seem to just get so much from the crowd.
Yeah. I got a lot out of the music, you know.
Yeah.
I got a lot from the music. I was perfectly happy if the crowd liked it. I would prefer they like it than that they didn't like it. But it wasn't what I was up there for. I don't know why. I get up there, I go, what the hell am I doing up here? These people are staring at me. You know? But I did like the music.
Yeah. Jumping back to Jen Napolitano, believe it or not, who is now head of the UC system, but she was head of Homeland Security for a while.
I think she can be brought around. That's my
I think
well, she basically is a good heart under there.
I think so, too.
We can bring her around. We got to whip her a little bit, but she'll come around. I like her.
I like her, too. But it made me think of the border and what it was like when you were young and your ability to go back and forth.
Well, that's something Marcella knows about because she grew up in Tucson in Nogales, which is the border town there, or Nogales, which is what English the Arguello version of it. And it was a wonderful little town. You know, both sides of the border had wonderful restaurants, wonderful shops. Yeah, you get a better hamburger on the American side, but you got really good every kind of food, Greek food. You know, it was a multicultural town. And, you know, there were a lot of, like, my father did business with everybody in northern Mexico. He owned a big hardware store. He sold them windmills, tractors, pumps, you know, tools. They would come up on a buying trip. Their wives would go to my brother-in-law's department store, which was Jacome's, and buy their evening gowns and whatever their nightgowns and their children's school clothes. Yeah. And their husbands would come to my father's store and buy all this stuff for their ranches, you know. And my dad would make that drive down all through northern Mexico to visit the ranches and see what people needed. And he had great relationship. And then we would go, there was a ball called the Blanco y Negro. It's like their debutante ball in Hermosillo. We would go to that and my sister would go and I would go. We would be dressed up in our ball gowns. Or we would go to a picnic or a baptism or a wedding. I mean, we socialized back and forth across the border very easily. There was no line at the border waiting to cross, you know. And we knew the families. They knew our families. Everybody intermarried and socialized and did whatever they did. But that's gone now. And those business relationships, you know, that border town is a scary place to be now because they throw sometimes they throw back 2,000 people that they've deported just from the United States, people that are right in the middle of having a job, you know, raising a child, whatever they were doing, living up here, and they just go, we got you, and then they throw them across the border, and they're just sitting there. They have no cell phone. In some cases, they don't have shoes because they took them away from them in jail. They don't have their belts. They just have the clothes on their back and no way to get home, you know. And home is up here anyway because they've been here for 18 years or 20 years or 5 years or whatever. So it's pretty bad down there. I've spent a lot of time with some of the groups that will go into the desert to try to find people that were stragglers that were trying to smuggle across and wind up, you know, with hypothermia, their feet full of cactus, you know, desperate with thirst. And a lot of people die. There's a huge number of them that die in the desert every year because the immigration laws are really awful. They're just cruel. They're mean. They're absolutely mm-hmm. counterproductive. They don't help business. I mean, these people come up here. They pay huge amounts of money into taxes. They pay sales taxes. And when they work, they pay into Social Security, but they are not citizens, so they can't take it out. So they're actually paying more into Social Security than they'll ever get back. They're helping us. And they renew us culturally. They renew our economy. They renew our workforce. It's important to have immigrants. But it's really important. And anybody will tell you that Rides with the Border Patrol has worked at all on the border is that the border, that those policies don't work. The fence doesn't work. It's easy to climb over it. You can make a door through it. You can tunnel under it. They build ramps and they drive semi-trucks over it. It's just ridiculous. What happens is the local contractors make a fortune by putting up the fence. And that's what it's been. It's been the hugest raid on the United States Treasury. You know, billions and billions and billions of dollars. The amount of money that it spends per square foot, you know, per foot for that fence. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could use that to build schools and, you know, drug rehab and... Or you could just give every citizen in Mexico a great big huge bonus and they won't have to migrate up here. Just give them the money, you know. Here you are. And they don't have to have the fence because the fence keeps all these, keeps animals from migrating. And it howls and moans at night because the wind tries to go through. You know, the fence has got this kind of thing like that. And the wind blows and it howls and moans and shrieks. You know, they say it's shrieking for the people who've died trying to cross it. It's just a horrible thing. It has to come down. It's like the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was a bad idea. Well, the border fence is an even worse idea than the Berlin Wall. And it's such an affront to this neighbor of ours. You know, they say, oh, we don't want any terrorists coming. Well, we insult Mexico on such a daily basis. That why they don't become terrorists and invade us is just a mystery to me. I think, why haven't they already done it? You know, we're the worst neighbors ever. Treat them with such disrespect. So, you know, they're just bringing about, you know, they're bringing about the situation that they say we have to fear. They're making it happen.
Thank
those
you
stupid
so
people.
Much.
You're so welcome.
This has been a delight for me, certainly. And obviously for them.
Thank you so much for being part of this conversation, and we just hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did. And again, we just want to remind you that this was a collaborative effort by Aviva Fest and the Commonwealth Club of California, and I want to acknowledge a special lady in the front row, Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club. She's been a wonderful friend and partner, and just, you know, muchísimas gracias for letting us be part of your family tonight. And so with that, we want to thank Linda Ronstadt, and we want to thank Barbara Marshman. We want to thank you, and, you know, we are now officially adjourning this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Thank you so much.